the way to start creating transformative meetings is well before anyone enters the room or the Zoom. It's pausing and asking, what is the purpose of this thing? And then getting other people aligned by what they think the purpose is. When we meet, so often we don't fully know why we're meeting and we waste a lot of time.
Today on In Session, leading the judiciary, Priya Parker, author of The Art of Gathering, shares a purpose-driven and people-centered approach to designing meaningful and memorable meetings. Ms. Parker encourages those who lead meetings, whom she calls hosts, to be intentional in creating purpose, relevance, and connection, whether in person or remotely. Ms. Parker says meeting hosts can wield significant influence from the moment an invitation is received through to the conclusion of an event. Also, the most successful meetings are those where guests are inspired and eager to participate, and upon leaving, feel their time has been exceptionally well spent. Those are the gatherings Ms. Parker challenges us to create. Priya Parker is a facilitator, strategic advisor, and the executive producer and host of the New York Times podcast, Together Apart. Trained in the field of conflict resolution, Ms. Parker has spent 20 years guiding leaders and groups through complicated conversations about community, identity, and vision at moments of transition. She studied organizational design at MIT, public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and political and social thought at the University of Virginia. Special thanks to today's host, Angela Long, Senior Education Specialist for Executive Education at the Federal Judicial Center. Angela, take it away.
Good afternoon, Priya. Thank you so much for joining us today for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were thrilled to read your book, The Art of Gathering, and it's The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And I think the subtitle is important because I think a lot of people probably think they know how to plan meetings or plan gatherings. And I feel like your approach is a little more nuanced and perhaps more nuanced than most people consider.
I love that. And the subtitle is one of the things our team is sort of most proud of. It's actually the subtitle that's often the most important explanatory note of what this thing is. So how we meet and why it matters is kind of the essential promise of the work.
To start us off, how do you define a gathering in general? And for our purposes, what constitutes a gathering in a work setting? And how is that perhaps different?
So I'm a group dialogue facilitator. That's my background. That's my training. That's still my day job. And so I'm interested in the life of groups. And I define a gathering as any time three or more people come together for a purpose with a beginning, middle, and end. So it ends. A gathering is different than a team or a community. Teams have gatherings. A meeting is a type of gathering. So really looking at the leadership of a group. And I'm really interested in anyone who's trying to shape the experience of three or more people, 12 people, 20 people, 100 people, and at a moment in time, an event. And I will also just add, the other way I think about a gathering as a temporary alternative world that any of us can create, any of us can attend, but a rave is different than a wedding, is different than a court proceeding. If you're a leader or a manager, you are inheriting someone else's, or you've been charged or tasked with creating your own.
So I love that word create, because a lot of times people think about meetings and they think they know how to plan that. And what you're getting at is it's more than planning, it's creating. And designing.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, that signifies a whole other level of intention.
That's such a beautiful distinction you're making, the difference between planning and creating. In a way, it is an act of creation. It is this sort of future promise and at some level, active influence that a group of people should come together at the same time, at the same place, whether in person or virtually, remotely, to talk about the same thing and share a moment of time together. And so often, one of the biggest mistakes we make when we gather is we assume that the purpose is obvious and shared. I know what a staff meeting is. I know what our town hall is. I know what a court proceeding is. And so often, because we assume a specific form in our head, we get too quickly to kind of planning the logistics, assuming that that's the right form. Well before the pandemic hit, studies showed that the number one cause of rage across employees, rage, was too many meetings. So meetings can be very bad. When we meet so often, we don't fully know why we're meeting and we waste a lot of time. I interviewed over 100 types of gatherers from all walks of life. And part of what all of these gatherers said to me in one way or another is that they don't have assumed lines in their head. They first ask, what is the purpose of this thing? What is the purpose of this staff meeting this week? What is the purpose of this retreat this year for this team? Why are we doing this? The way through to start creating transformative meetings is well before anyone enters the room or the Zoom. It's by starting and pausing and asking, what is the purpose of this thing? And then getting other people aligned.
If you're a leader of an organization and you're used to doing things a certain way, this might be a new idea. What is the best way to get clear on purpose?
So the first is to just pause and hold the assumption that of course you know what the purpose is. One practice is to say you're thinking about your staff meeting or say you're thinking about a future leadership retreat. It's to pause and have everyone write down on a piece of paper without peeking, what do they think the purpose of the staff meeting is? And in a lot of teams that I work with, you get 6 different answers, 12 different answers. And that's data. So very simply, start by asking people, what do you think the purpose of this thing is? And not making that a taboo question. The second, just if you're thinking about it for yourself, is to first ask, what is the need here? What is the need for this team? Or what is the need for this court? Or what is the need for this circuit? Or what is the need for this district in this moment? And given that need, who might we bring together who can uniquely address that need? Another way to think about it, this is sort of a reverse engineer. I sometimes say to my clients, I want you to plan a meeting that people would cancel other things to be at.
Right? We'd all love to plan that kind of meeting, right?
We don't like to be at that kind of meeting, right?
Exactly. Like
how do you raise the relevance? And at some level, it's honoring your people so that they know why they're there. They're of use rather than used. What are we actually doing this for? And what does that actually look like? A purpose is not a category. So a networking night is not a purpose. It's an activity. Who are you connecting? For what ends? An activity is not a purpose. Sharing information, to what end? Why are we sharing information, right? What is the need? What kind of information? And so often we stop too soon before we really get very clear on what our purpose is each time.
So it sounds like that's one of the things that people most often get wrong when they're thinking about designing or creating an event. Purpose gets skipped. Are there any other things that get skipped?
We tend to assume that the meeting begins at the moment of entry. So when people enter the Zoom or enter the Microsoft Teams or enter the room, and actually the event or the meeting or the gathering starts at the moment of discovery in the guest's mind, meaning the moment that they realize, oh, there's this future happening. You're thinking about whether you attend or not attend, what you're, you know, what else you may need to move to be able to be there, whether or not this is something that's relevant to you from the moment of discovery. And one of the biggest mistakes we make is we underhost from the beginning. And we make the mistake of thinking that our invitations are carriers of logistics. Time, date, place. But actually, our invitations are the opening salvo of that world that you're creating. And an invitation is an opportunity to tell a story, right? So very practically, what do I mean by that? First of all, names carry social contracts, right? Is this a workshop? Is this a brainstorming? Is this a charrette? All of these words actually mean different things, and they will prime your audience. They're all words with specific context that actually create an emotional response. They create an intellectual context. And so begin by knowing that you're actually hosting your guests, your managees, from the very beginning. And so really think about what the invitation says, what you call your event, and the story you tell in this event, because you're actually priming them to show up in a certain way, rather than having everyone try to figure out what's going on in the room.
And it sounds like you're also needing to think about, what do you want your invitees to feel when they receive that invitation?
What do you want them to feel? What do they need to know? Person I know was trying to create a mentorship program. It was a mentorship program for women within this larger firm. And one of the blockages as they started serving employees was that there was a perception that people can't show vulnerability in this firm, in this organization. And they wanted to start a mentorship program to pair senior female leaders with incoming staff. The senior leaders, the senior women in this context, were totally up for it. There was a perception that they wouldn't be. So in the actual invitation, it was something like, "Welcome to our inaugural mentorship program. We invite you to come and we invite you to bring a fear you have and or a moment of vulnerability that changed you." And then below, they had three of their senior leaders answer the question, and they pasted their answers in the email. There's so much work done in that invitation. People were surprised, like, wow, oh, this is really something. This is going to be substantive. Wow, they're going to show up. Every invitation is a social contract, right? It's these mini constitutions. And so often we underuse them. And we, in any context, in any work context, in any social context, in any community context, we actually need to understand what the terms are. What are we expected to show up and do? What side of myself am I showing? Who else will be there? What's this going to feel like? And our invitations are wonderful opportunities to actually begin to prime people to understand, what are the rules of the road? And do I want to say yes or do I want to say no? And how do I show up to be successful?
I love the idea that as soon as someone sees that invitation or that announcement, they begin thinking about, is this something that I want to attend?
This work, I call it purposely the art of gathering, not the art of hosting, in part because guests have a lot of power. And most of us, myself included, are actually guests much more often than we're hosts. And so just to flip the script a little bit, it's almost like a spiritual practice to practice intentional guesting, which is, as a guest, when you receive an invitation, when you receive a calendar hold, when you receive, you know, whatever invitation it is, to just pause and before reacting and either accepting absolutely yes or no, or I think the worst button, maybe, just to pause and to just think, okay, how does this land on me? Do I feel a desire to go to this thing? Do I feel dread? And it's data. It doesn't mean you go. It doesn't mean you don't go. It's just data. The second is, once you sort of think about whether or not you want to attend this thing, is to either practice what I call an enthusiastic yes or a connected no. So I often think about an invitation as like, it's someone throwing you a ball. The guest has a role to actually catch that ball and then throw it back. And we so often think the only option of throwing something back is saying yes, right? But actually a connected no. Thank you so much for thinking about me. I am so delighted you invited me to this retreat. I unfortunately am focused on this right now, but I think what you're focusing on, the way you're bringing people together and the content and the panels are completely amazing. And I'm so sad to miss it. Warmest, Priya. And the last thing I'll say is the enthusiastic yes is, we've all hosted meetings or hosted retreats or hosted parties, and you send something out and it's kind of it's vulnerable, right? And you always have Bob enthusiastically responding and be like, yes, yes, I'm going to be there. And you're like, thank you, Bob. Part of kind of being a better host is also practicing being a better guest. Think about, if I'm going to choose to be there, how do I bring my energy to this thing and help it be the wholest version of what it can be?
Intentional guesting. I love that. I want to touch on the idea of generous authority.
Generous authority, you know, people often think that gathering is about connection, and it is. But gathering is also about power. And a good host understands that they wield power. And a good host uses their power for the good of the group to help it achieve its purpose. And to do that, generous authority, you have to practice three things. The first is to protect your guests from each other. The second is to connect your guests to each other. And the third is to temporarily equalize them. If you walk into a room and a group of 100 people or 30 people, you need to actually start thinking about, okay, who knows the most people in the room? Who knows the least? And how do we temporarily equalize them? And in the Art of Gathering book, I have a lot of examples of very simple ways conferences or organizers of large gatherings help shift the norms to temporarily equalize them. So one of my favorite examples is a character in the Art of Gathering, Nora Abu State, when she lays out the meal of a 40-person dinner of people who don't know each other. She says, "Welcome to our dinner. As you notice, the food is served family style. But here's the thing," she says, "I invite you to serve everyone around you, to not worry about serving yourself. Because when you serve everyone around you, everyone gets fed." She's equalizing her guests. She's giving them social permission to shift. Because most of us, no matter how senior we are entering a room and worrying whether or not, what do I do here? Do I belong here? Are these my people? How do I interact? And in a growingly diverse world, that's going to be more and more true. And so the good host thinks deeply about creating and determining the relevant need, bringing people along with that need, or listening and changing the need if they're getting new data, and creating a shared experience without all having to be the same.
We talked about the purpose. We talked a little bit about structure, that there's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end. And of course, there's also venue or place. So what is important to think about when you're thinking about a venue or a place for a gathering?
One of the things the pandemic did for us was, by taking gathering from us, we began to see it. It's like, oh, this is how we exchange information. Oh, classrooms. Oh, we actually meet to teach, right? Oh, courts. Oh, we meet to adjudicate, right? And all of a sudden, for, you know, 2+ years, many of our gatherings moved out of place and into a remote context. And so I'll talk about both the power of choosing intentionally the place if it's in person, as well as how to create a sense of place if it's remote. So rooms come with scripts. The courtroom is an iconic room that comes with a script. The judge's bench in a traditional courtroom is elevated. You approach the judge, right? It's inherently intimidating. You come in and you play a very specific role. But ballrooms come with scripts. Classrooms come with scripts. Think about, given my purpose, what is a place that would serve this purpose? And what might block it? There are certain contexts in which the roles that are attributed in a space actually work against the purpose. So I'll give an example. One of the people I interviewed in the Art of Gathering is a facilitator who was brought in to work with a senior multinational agency, very old agency. And he and his team were brought in part to shift the power dynamics and to get the team to actually start exchanging information and have a different way with one another. That was literally why they were invited to be brought in. And he stepped into the room that they were assigned, and there were placards right on the table. The names had been set up so that the senior most person was at the center of the table. It was like an org chart, right, all around the table. And he looked at it and he said, very astute facilitator, "I can't work here. The scripts and the infrastructure and the architecture are reifying that which you're asking me to change." And they said, "Oh, well, the tables are, you know, here and all the AV equipment is plugged in." And he practiced what Artful Gathers practices. He didn't accept the default setup, because most people aren't actually thinking about these dynamics. And so he called the tech teams, they moved out the tables, they took off all the name tags, and still, he said, working within the building was still very difficult to shift the context. Some of it is super practical. So if you go to a restaurant, say you have a team meeting at a restaurant, you know, what is the audio like? If you're wanting to do a night of stories or 15 toasts, you may want to think about a private room rather than a public room so that people can speak freely. How far apart are bodies around a table, like a family style table versus kind of like two lines on a tennis match? And so thinking very deeply about place. And then the last thing I'll just say is when you are leading a remote meeting or gathering, the role of the host is to create and stitch together psychological togetherness when we don't have physical togetherness. You know, architecture does a lot of the stitching of our physical togetherness in ways we don't even think, right? You lower your head perhaps to go through a doorway. The texture of a floor changes from carpet to floor to tile. All of these are actually giving signals to our brain that we're entering into new spaces. In most of our remote contexts, it's a contextless space. I often joke, you can't hide a bad meeting on Zoom, right? It's like, there's no almonds in the middle of the table to reach or, you know, go get, or to grab your colleague on the way out to have the actual meeting. You're just kind of all there staring at each other. And so a couple of ways to create psychological togetherness. The first 5% of any meeting really matters. That's when you're setting up the norms. It's also when people feel like, oh, this is a place I can kind of talk, or this is a place where this is not my meeting. And when people are still coming in, and particularly for larger groups to make it not feel so contextless, anonymous, or big, is to use in the first opening moments in the chat box, ask questions that are sort of relevant to the group, but not necessarily totally about work. So one they love is, I often ask people, what's the first concert you went to and who took you? And all of a sudden, you're creating context. You see the chat light up. Oh, New Kids on the Block, Bob Dylan, Janet Jackson, Madonna. Oh, wow. I didn't realize that their first concert also was the Backstreet Boys. And part of what happens is, first of all, studies show that people are more likely to participate if they've participated once, whether they say their name aloud, whether they use the chat box. And so you're creating a social permission and a context that, like, we can do this here. But the second is that you're giving people context, particularly in remote work, of each other. So when you're working on something and the going gets tough, you have one mental note that's like, oh, maybe I'll pick up the phone and just see what happened. Like, their first concert was my first concert, right? And so the work of a leader, the work of a manager, particularly in distributed work and particularly in larger rooms, is to continually at different moments create connected tissue and context that allows people to know things about one another that is appropriate within the work context, that helps us realize that none of us is a monolith. And part of it, you know, the judiciary may be different, but so much of remote work, one of the things we've lost is kind of just like the informal banter. If you're moving down a hallway or if you're washing your hands in the shared restroom, you're kind of bantering with one another, chatting with one another. Oh, where'd you get your bag? Or wow, are you running the 5K this weekend? And on remote and virtual meetings, 40 people don't need to hear about whether or not you stubbed your toe. But actually, stubbing your toe is the small talk of group life. I know a team that is a very kind of fast-moving team. They're distributed. They see each other all day long, and often with clients, sometimes with themselves, and just like very like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and always like get straight to work. And they started realizing their vibe as a group was kind of off. And so they started an experiment where they're starting to do water cooler Wednesdays. And every Wednesday at 3 p.m. for 15 minutes, that's short, they do a virtual water cooler. And the principals show up, which actually makes a difference than everyone else showing up. And the only rule is you don't talk about work. And I checked back in with that team 6 weeks later and they were back intact. It was a very, again, what is the purpose? What is the need? The first iteration of what they were doing when they realized that they were only like workhorses with each other was some people started to try to chat at the beginning of meetings and then other people kind of got annoyed. Again, know your group, know the need, know the pace, know what is necessary in a certain moment. And so again, by paying attention to what's actually happening in your group, they realized for this group, let's actually carve out a specific time where we do this. So then the next 17 meetings we have on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we're in the mode, we're doing our work, but we're also slightly chuckling because we know about Sanjay's new poster behind him and how arrived from his mother. I'm making this up. At some level, what we're talking about is creating a sense of belonging when we're not all in the same space and we're not all the same.
Are there times when it's okay to just have less formal gatherings?
I kind of want to detangle formality from structure, from intention. Purpose need not be serious. A simpler or more helpful word is intention. If you're a leader, if you have a manager, what is the need here? Am I accurately assessing the need? Or do I need to talk to some of my people? And again, ask them, what do you think of the purposes? What do you think the biggest need is for our group right now? Because if you have proximity to power and you're a leader, you're much more likely to feel like you belong to a place. We tend to assume that the relationships we have, other people have in different versions, and that's not always the case.
What should leaders know about gatherings that are smaller, say a few people versus larger gatherings, maybe even up to a few hundred people?
When it comes to gatherings, size really matters, and different sizes serve different purposes. So groups of six are really good for having distributed and engaged conversation. It's much more likely if you're debating between six and eight. Group of six is much more likely to have one conversation. A group of eight is more likely to have two or three conversations, which isn't a bad thing either. So a group eight to 12, more people are more likely to talk to different people and have dyads, basically one-on-ones. It's harder to have a single conversation, but it is possible with a well-held host or facilitator. When you get to groups of 20 to 30, they're really good for kind of buzz and diversity, and they're able to kind of move around a room, particularly if you're in person, and meet different people. And in a group of 20 or 30, if it's not well held, people will much more likely to go to those they already know. And so you need to have more design around how to actually create cross flow and particularly help those who have less social capital in the room find ways to kind of be at the center of things. One of the things I often hear in companies and in organizations is like the best conversations are usually smaller, six people, eight people. It starts getting really unwieldy when it's 20 or 100. And yet one of the things that the pandemic did is Zoom has endless windows. It's not limited by 12 people. There's no fire code, right? Like you can literally have 500 people on your town hall. First of all, not everybody has to play the same role in every meeting. It is a false notion that a 60 minutes with 150 people on Zoom is a democratic meeting. It's not. And it shouldn't be pretended to be. And so it's like anyone can talk, whatever. It's like, just don't even say that because it's not true. But it's not that, it's not a bad thing. It just depends on what the purpose is. What leaders in remote organizations need to understand is at some level, your town hall or your morning meeting is the cultural metabolism of your organization now. And so at some level, it is a show. And I don't mean that as a manipulation, but it is your 60 minutes or your 30 minutes where you are deeply thinking about what is it on this day that I want this organization to be thinking about? Who are we? What is important here? It's almost like thinking about yourself as a podcast producer. Do we spend 20 minutes on one really thorny issue? Or do we try to get through as much decisions as possible? The last thing I'll just say is, we confuse apprenticeship with participation. You have to look at what is appropriate to share with a larger group and what should not be shared and needs to actually some privacy and needs some, doesn't need transparency right away and needs space to kind of like think ideas through. These are design questions.
We have a lot to strive for in creating better gatherings. And I know your book has a wealth of information. Is there anything else that you would like us to know about your work or about resources that folks can tap into?
Well, thank you so much for having me and being in conversation with me. On my website, priyaparker.com, we have a workbook called The New Rules of Gathering. It's a free workbook that we can share with you all to just start practicing that simple first step, which is what is the actual purpose here? What is the need?
Priya, thank you so much for some really good food for thought in planning future gatherings.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Angela, and thanks to our listeners. To hear more episodes of this podcast, visit the Executive Education page on fjc.dcn and click or tap Podcast. You can also search for and subscribe to this podcast on your mobile device via Apple, Google, Spotify, or YouTube. In Session, Leading the Judiciary is produced by Shelley Easter. Our program is supported by Lori Murphy, Jamie Mitchell, and the entire studio and live production team. Thanks for listening. Until next time. This podcast was produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.